Jim Russell is a geographer, a social theorist, and a would-be social entrepreneur with a unique perspective on what he calls the Pittsburgh diaspora. That's the network of ex-Pittsburghers scattered around the world. Jim's notion is that we've only begun to experience the ways in which the internet is changing our relationship to geography and transforming the problem of brain drain into the opportunity for brain circulation. You're clearly a man on a mission. You're trying to figure out, on the one hand, how to bring people to Pittsburgh, and on the other hand, how to bring Pittsburgh to people who aren't there anymore.
Right.
And it's really, I think, about both of those things, and of course also not just about Pittsburgh, but about what, in this world of mobility and telecommunications, what does migration mean? What does it mean to be part of a community? What does it mean to be affiliated with a community that you have physically left? And how does all this tie into economics? If somebody said, what's your mission, man, what would you say?
I would say that the mission is to turn the problem of mobile human capital into an asset. That's really the fundamental mission.
Okay.
I've been able to reduce it to a better and better soundbite as I've moved along.
Mm-hmm.
The initial problem was just simply Pittsburgh and other cities were not doing very well and are not doing very well in the emerging economy, so
mm-hmm.
this post-industrial economy.
Mm-hmm.
And they're really struggling with this. And the problem tends to be framed as everyone's leaving.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something I've spoken with a number of respected experts about, and we've had a number of conversations. And I was struck by one conversation I had with a friend of mine who was a professor at a small school in South Central Colorado. And we were talking about how we were connecting those students outside of their region. And then I was struck by the thought that if we did a really, really good job at educating these students at this college,
mm-hmm.
that college would lose out on its investment.
Exactly.
That is, the students would leave.
The success is that you are penalized by the loss of the investment that you made in those people.
Exactly. And so that's what really led to the idea of the problem of mobility and the problem of investing in human capital, that if you invest a lot, it was highly likely that another region would reap the benefits of that investment.
So before we go too much farther, can we, for people who haven't read your blog and don't have a context here, can you sort of talk us through how you got activated by these ideas and what your Pittsburgh connection has been, first of all, and second of all, what your sort of professional and educational inclinations are that have led you to be thinking about things in this way?
I should say up front, I'm not a native Pittsburgher.
Okay.
And not being born there, I'll never be counted as a native Pittsburgher.
Okay.
Nonetheless, my Western Pennsylvania upbringing has allowed me to relate culturally very easily to Pittsburghers and their plight.
Mm-hmm.
Also, part of it is just being the sports affiliation that I've been a lifelong Pittsburgh Steelers fan.
Uh-huh.
I've been involved in an online community of Steelers fans, and I was very struck by the network of trust we were able to develop. And in terms of my personal role, is that I felt compelled to help people out in that community. That is, when they asked questions or they needed information, I used my research skills to provide them with that information. And I was always glad to do it. And I thought, wow, that's a very powerful network. Here we are, all these Steeler fans scattered about the United States, if not the whole world.
Mm-hmm.
And we work very hard for each other pro bono. And I wondered about the potential of that network.
Mm-hmm.
And when looking at the problems of Pittsburgh, you know, I finally got to a point where I said, well, if I wanted to help Pittsburgh, how might I do it? And if there's one thing I know very well, it's that diaspora. It's that Pittsburgh network of people who used to live there that are now scattered about the United States.
The word diaspora usually refers to a situation where people have, against their will, had to leave their homeland and have been dispersed elsewhere.
Right.
For political or religious or economic reasons. And that's part of the story here, but I know that you don't see it entirely in those terms. This isn't only that people have been driven out by bad circumstances, but they've
right.
simply been attracted to other circumstances, and we're in an increasingly mobile environment.
If you're talking about the beginnings of the word, and usually it meant Jewish diaspora,
mm-hmm.
so it was Jewish persecution that pushed Jews out of areas. but they maintained a really strong connection to homeland.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say now diaspora tends to mean those who have left the home seeking economic opportunity. So I wouldn't really necessarily say they're pushed out. And I think the diaspora exemplar is the diaspora of India. And that's very much a pull factor, if you will. It's Indians seeking opportunity elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a certain amount of displacement. They're kind of caught between places. And this is well documented, and you can find it in literature, like in Salman Rushdie's books. And, you know, the Indian saying that, oh, I don't feel really comfortable where I am, but also I can't go home. I'm caught in between.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because I recently became aware of this phenomenon called the Return to India movement.
Mm-hmm.
I've obviously, being in the software business, known lots and lots of software engineers from India working in the U.S., and I've discovered that there's a whole movement about the return to India. There's a blog which records the experiences of a guy who graduated from the Indian Technical Institute, was working at Microsoft in his early 20s, was there for 4 or 5 years, worked on Vista, actually, got kind of disillusioned with the whole scene and was really homesick, and finally took the decision to return home. And this blog is all about that phenomenon and about the trade-offs of doing that, but also about the opportunities to be in that culture, which they really hadn't wanted to leave and only had left for reasons of economic opportunity, and are now starting to find ways to recreate that opportunity at home. So a fascinating...
Yeah, it's a perfect example, and it's something that's received a lot of press, and I think it's fairly well known. The novelty in this situation is conceiving of a domestic diaspora akin to an international diaspora.
Yeah.
I'm really struck by the inability of domestic populations to embrace that idea. And I'm not really sure why that occurs, because you look at the Indian situation, and I think it's fairly obvious to a number of people that in some sense it works. I mean, there are drawbacks, as you pointed out. There are issues with it, but we're looking at an economic success story. And it started out as an economic concern. I mean, India, among other countries, they were extremely worried about what they call brain drain.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, again, all their investment in human capital was leaving the country, going to other places, so the United States was the one benefiting.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And it was seen as a zero-sum game. So whatever the America's gain was, India's loss.
Yeah.
And I think what we're seeing now, this concept of brain circulation, is that it can be mutually beneficial. That it's good that you educate your people that they might leave, but then it gives you a connection to the vanguard, to people on the cutting edge of ideas, to the cutting edge of economic innovation. And you just have to figure out how to tap into it.
You used the term brain circulation. That's pretty interesting. So it sounds like what you're saying is that this isn't just about a one-way movement. It's not just brain drain. It's that there's an inflow and an outflow, and you'd like to achieve some kind of balance. It's extremely hard, actually, to understand what the regional connection is.
It is difficult, but as a geographer, when I look at it, for me, it seems relatively easy to understand, because I see a tension between the emerging geographies, like, say, of brain circulation, and the established romantic geographies, like of defined contiguous Pittsburgh region.
Mm-hmm.
Pittsburghers aren't particularly interested in seeing a bunch of outsiders move into Pittsburgh, which would be really the best way to improve the economic situation in that area.
Mm-hmm.
They want the Pittsburghers to return because they trust them. And so they really look at their region, their geography, as, you know, very small, defined, and almost hermetically sealed.
Hmm.
So when people leave, they wash their hands of them. They're like, well, they gave up on us.
Hmm.
So if they're not living here, they're not part of us. There isn't any kind of identification. There isn't any kind of relationship. And you'll see in any sort of diasporic population a sense of regret that, oh, well, I left, but I can't go back because they don't love me anymore. I betrayed them, and that I'm being pushed away.
Hmm.
And we're seeing a large movement right now to regionalize economies, so moving away from thinking of economics on a nation-state scale. And we're seeing innovation being fostered at a regional level. I'm not necessarily sure that's a great idea. I think that that's just taking the old model of the nation state and trying to apply it to a smaller scale, in this case the regional scale. And what I'm arguing for is a network sense of region, that, you know, people who feel affiliated to Pittsburgh, no matter where they are, that's your Pittsburgh region.
Okay.
And so you could have, you know, like a little Italy in New York, or a Chinatown in whatever major metropolitan area. You could conceivably have a little Pittsburgh, except for there wouldn't be this highly concentrated area of where Pittsburghers had come together.
Mm-hmm.
Nonetheless, they're extremely present in these regions. You can see them at Steelers bars. You can see them driving around. You know, I run into ex-Pittsburghers all the time, and they're identifiable by their cultural traits. Nonetheless, they're not part of that region. In a sense, it's sort of reclaiming the people instead of the place.
So given that that happens informally all the time, mm-hmm. anyway, there's more to the story here. What you're suggesting is that by formalizing this network in some way, there can be economic flows that will benefit
right.
both the place that is the focus, in this case Pittsburgh, mm-hmm. and other regions as well. So how would you envision that working?
I can look at what's going on in terms of the India diaspora and say, well, can we reproduce that? And I think to some extent we could, but there's also various elements of that diaspora that there's no way Pittsburgh could reproduce. Really, the main problem is how do you enfranchise these ex-Pittsburghers in Pittsburgh, you know, in the physical place of the Pittsburgh region? And really, we're not set up to do that.
What would that mean, though?
Formally organizing that network of ex-Pittsburghers, meaning that they should get in touch with each other, that they can share each other as a resource.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as that network and those connections intensify, then we start to create a critical mass that then could turn around and re-engage Pittsburgh, but this time from a point of strength. And that's exactly what happened with the India diaspora. You know, you had successful Indian entrepreneurs, like, say, here in the United States, Silicon Valley, Seattle, and then they finally had enough capital, enough wherewithal, enough power to go back to India and essentially push political change, because there had to be political change at the structural level in order to allow there to be the development of the entrepreneurial culture that was so successful in the United States, like around Silicon Valley,
yeah.
to prosper in India.
And in fact, from what I can see, it's a huge uphill struggle for these folks. And so, well, first of all, it's not the case that this reverse migration was engineered by the Indian government. As far as I can tell, there's not been some sort of big program to bring back the brains that drained away. It's happening because this, what you would call the diaspora that's in other places, is coming to this conclusion on its own and is returning for its own reasons, right?
Yeah, change has to be diaspora-driven.
Yeah.
It will not come from the inside of the homeland.
Yeah, but then second of all, the frustration that I read in this blog is palpable. And his advice, in fact, to other R2Iers, Return to India folks, is don't romanticize what it's going to be like when you come back here. It is still mostly what it was in terms of just the friction of getting things done and the bureaucracy. But I like what you said. I mean, the presence of these folks is going to certainly push for change in those areas, and that will be a benefit, a huge benefit, to, in this case, India. I'm trying to map that onto the inter-regional effects that you would imagine within, let's say, the United States. I'm just wondering why you think it wouldn't directly map, first of all. Why wouldn't it?
Oh, why wouldn't the Indian model directly map?
Yeah, you suggested it won't.
You know, one thing you have to keep in mind is that we're dealing with a very small subset of the Indian diaspora when we're talking about returning home and affecting change.
Mm-hmm.
What Pittsburgh lacks that India does not lack is a substantial population of entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm.
There are Pittsburgh expatriates in Silicon Valley, but not to the kind of numbers we're talking about when we look at Chinese or Indian international migrants.
Mm-hmm.
The international migrants from India, that's the cream of the crop.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
What you get in Pittsburgh is there's a lot, when you talk about domestic migrations, there's a lot lower barrier to movement.
Right.
International migration, extremely high barriers. It's very difficult for someone lacking education and resources to leave their country and go to another country. you know, unless there's some sort of formal network for, say, itinerant labor.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of the Indian diaspora, we have a really large population that's been extremely successful in the world of high tech. So they're like masters of the new economy.
Mm-hmm.
And Pittsburgh has some of those people, but not a lot of those people.
Mm-hmm.
And so the prospects of organizing the Pittsburgh diaspora at the same level that this entrepreneurial Indian diaspora is organizing is highly unlikely. There just isn't the kind of intellectual capital available in the Pittsburgh diaspora.
Okay.
You know, just because you have people with high school educations who were able to move to, say, Florida.
Okay.
They would be very interested in belonging to the network and connecting into it, but to the extent that they have the background necessary to, say, drive a network knowledge economy, it's probably not going to happen, at least in the near term.
Well, even if it did, what would be the benefit to them and the benefit to, in this case, Pittsburgh, the place they left, if that were to happen?
If it were to happen, I think what would happen was that there would be capital in Pittsburgh, like, say, in a major bank like PNC Bank, could find opportunities to invest their money. And it would be not only within their region or where they have banking presence, but it could be all around the United States where there's large populations of ex-Pittsburghers.
Okay, so that starts to get to some concrete examples here of how this could work. So in this case, what you would be leveraging is a kind of a trust network, which is based in regional affiliation, but mm-hmm. where the flow of money is dispersed across a much wider area. Following those lines of affiliation.
Exactly. Wherever you see, in various networks, wherever you see high levels of trust, you see capital flows.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the Indian diaspora bears this out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that if you're looking for startup money, you know, from, say, a Silicon Valley venture capitalist, you know, the New York Times had an article this weekend saying, well, you better live within 20 minutes of the investor.
Right.
Unless you're Indian and you've had experience in Silicon Valley, then they will send money to India through you because there's a high level of trust already developed between that Indian entrepreneur and the venture capitalist.
Okay. So then in one way of looking at this, there is an opportunity for banks in Pittsburgh to find investment opportunities elsewhere. But the reverse right. of that would be that to the extent that the network feeds into Pittsburgh, there is the possibility for investment dollars to also flow in. Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, exactly. If you look at problems in Pittsburgh, there's certain deficiencies in human capital.
Mm-hmm.
You have a startup that's coming out of the University of Pittsburgh, and someone says, I could really get going, but you know, I can't find the right chief financial officer in
mm-hmm.
Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe you could find the right chief financial officer in Indianapolis
mm-hmm.
who used to live in Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
And you would be willing to engage that person because you have a shared experience.
Okay.
And, you know, it's just a way to sort through the variety of opportunities. We can learn about various talent pools and areas of human capital that are around the world, but tapping into those pools, it's extremely difficult unless there's some common point of reference,
mm-hmm.
some sort of connection, because as I said, the capital flows are all along these lines of trust.
Right. So the idea here would be that it could well be the case that the Pittsburgh startup that you just mentioned could happen to know about an ex-Pittsburgher who is trusted, who is in Indianapolis, and make contact with that person, and that person might indeed be willing to return for this opportunity. So those kinds mm-hmm. of things are happening at, let's say, a relatively low frequency, but it sounds like what you're getting at here is that some more formalization of the network could increase the probability of things like that happening. Is that part of it?
Yeah, that's definitely the case. I've spent some time back in Pittsburgh talking to some economic stakeholders there, and I posed the question to them very directly: would you be interested in a network of expatriate Pittsburghers?
Mm-hmm.
And then their eyes broaden. You know, yes, we've tried this before. We failed. It's one thing to say you want to find them. It's another thing entirely to formally network them.
Mm-hmm.
And even from my standpoint, that's somewhat of a mystery. Like, do I have a magic formula that say, well, you know, give me some sort of affiliation network and I'll intensify the relationship.
Right.
I have some ideas, but, you know, if I had a magic formula, you know, people would be calling me all the time and
right.
hiring me to come in and troubleshoot and then build these networks from the ground up.
Right. That's the sense I get from reading your stuff. You sense an opportunity here, but you see all of the things that are happening in this emergent field of social networking, and you're kind of thinking, well, you know, this has to apply to this problem in some way. I just don't know exactly what it is yet.
Yeah, exactly, and that's the whole reason of blogging these ideas.
Yeah.
Is one, it helps me work through the various ideas. You know, just writing them out.
Yeah.
It helps clarify these ideas. But more importantly, that as more people become aware of the blog, what I've found is that they point me in certain directions. They they tell me, like, oh, well, you should look at this blog of this Indian entrepreneur who's gone back to India. And, you know, and I can look at that and say, wow, here are all his problems and here are all the things that worked. You know, I can learn from that.
Yeah.
I'm fully ready to admit that I don't have all the answers. But that's why you blog. I think you blog to put some ideas out there in hopes of tapping into that collaborative knowledge base that's developing on the internet.
Yeah. So one of the connections that I noticed that you've made is to Richard Florida, who I haven't actually read his book, but I have heard a couple of talks that he's given on this creative class concept. And I know that you've been thinking about that a lot. So for people who don't have that background, can you say a little bit about sort of, first of all, what his thesis is, and second of all, you know, where you kind of agree and disagree?
Sure. Creative class concept is one that if you have a number of creative people in an area, that's going to be good for the knowledge economy.
Mm-hmm.
That gives you access to lots of human capital. And so the idea is, how do you attract or retain this creative class?
Which he defines very broadly, by the way, right?
I mean, if you're looking for a critique, that's a common one.
Yeah.
That who counts as creative and who doesn't count.
Right.
In terms of looking at it economically, that's problematic. Really, what I think Florida is looking at is tolerance. He was a professor in Pittsburgh.
Oh, he was. I didn't know that.
He was a professor in Pittsburgh,
oh.
And of course Pittsburgh, notoriously so, has problem retaining and attracting creative types, however you might define that.
Okay. So he ended up using Pittsburgh as one of his negative examples? He's very much about sort of picking winners and losers in this game, and so I imagine then that Pittsburgh was, from his perspective, one of the losers?
I speculate that he simply saw what was going on in Pittsburgh and tried to figure out, well, what's wrong? And he was on a number of economic boards that were trying to help Pittsburgh.
Okay.
And he's made it quite clear that Pittsburghers were not receptive to his ideas, that this attraction of the creative class or cultivating whatever was necessary to attract or retain the creative class wasn't something that they were interested in, and that he was so frustrated that he left, and he's now in the D.C. area. So, yes, Pittsburgh's a loser. If you look at his work, what it says is basically we're going to have a smaller group of winners and more losers.
Yeah.
And that we're going to have a small number of metropolitan areas where the creative class will flock because they need face-to-face interaction. They need to rub elbows with other creative types.
Right.
And the rich will get richer and the poor will get poorer.
Right.
And in some sense, that may make sense because if you look at it from a standpoint of mobility, we have more and more mobility, more and more ability to pick up and leave. Particularly the well-educated, then why wouldn't they go to these places? And in fact, I think the data suggest that this is indeed the case. He had a very compelling argument in that people with advanced degrees were rather evenly distributed in 1970.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can look at maps of that and say, yes, that seems like a reasonable conclusion. And then look at it now, and they're highly concentrated in a few places. So we are seeing a great migration, if you will. Just a matter of first saying, well, what exactly is going on? And then the game is, well, extrapolating it. You know, so what kind of predictive value do you have? And I think that tends to be what the rub is. So if Richard Florida is correct, then what good would it do to hire him, say, to help Cleveland.
Mm-hmm. You'd have no chance anyway, because the cards are dealt wrong. That's just not going to happen in his view. Yeah.
Exactly. I think he says, well, we could do this, 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 and this, but, you know, New York's gain is Cleveland's loss. Well, if that's the case, I'm sorry, but people aren't going to go to Cleveland instead of New York.
Right. Your critique would be that potentially there can be a return to the kind of more even distribution of creative talent, and that the mechanisms that you imagine would sustain that.
As I see the emergent network online, right now everyone's saying, oh, well, I was supposed to face geography, but instead geography now matters more than ever.
Mm-hmm.
And I accept that, but I don't think that that necessarily means that's going to be the case from here on out, because what I see is the technologies in place for this kind of connectivity that would allow people to cut the tether to whatever location. But the socialization doesn't yet exist. I mean, people do not know how to act online in a non-face-to-face environment. They're dependent on the face-to-face interaction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're not socialized in that way. And what I imagine is, so you take the case of the Indian diaspora, they've come up with a couple social innovations that have allowed them to remain connected to India and then sort of foster what, you know, I said was brain circulation.
So what do you think those social innovations are?
Well, we're looking at trust at a distance. So why is it that Silicon Valley will only invest in startups that are 20 minutes away, except in the case of the Indian diaspora?
Hmm.
Here we have a great anomaly.
Hmm.
To the extent that we can explain that anomaly is to the extent we can understand the socialization that's necessary for, you know, distance trust.
Hmm.
You know, you have various technological innovations throughout history that have allowed for trust at a larger scale. You know, without vernacular and the printing press, you don't have nation states. You know, you can't act at that scale. You know, you can't build trust at that scale. So now we have various revolutions in telecommunications. You know, notice I coupled the printing press with vernacular. The vernacular is the social end of things. So what we need is the equivalent of vernacular for various forms of telecommunications now. You know, what would be the vernacular that would allow someone in India to get money from Silicon Valley Bank? How do they speak? How mm-hmm. do they act mm-hmm. that allows Silicon Valley Bank to say, this is a good investment?
Hmm.
And I'll say, for me, it's a very open question. I'm just getting into that area, just discovering how rich the social innovations are. But,
yeah.
You know, to the extent I understand them, I'll readily admit that. I'm just scratching the surface.
Well, you know, they're evolving monthly, and there's no one on planet Earth who has inhabited this electronic social space for very long, because it's only existed for a while. So we, as a species, have essentially got no experience transferring habits and ways of relating to one another from the physical world into this electronically mediated environment. And we're making it up as we go along.
You make the point perfectly. Why might Richard Florida be wrong? Why might all the people who claim, well, the internet hasn't effaced geography the way we thought it would?
Yeah.
You know, we haven't had enough time.
Yeah.
This hasn't taken, you know, we're still figuring this out. I still speculate that that's going to be the case. And we may be closer to that than most people think. You know, that to the extent I'm seeing the Indian diaspora succeed, to the extent I'm seeing the World Bank embrace the model of brain circulation and now frame brain drain in very positive terms,
mm-hmm.
You know, strikes me as a rapid social transformation that's going on. That is, you can be in India and not physically be in India.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking at these populations, these diasporas, these in-between people, these liminal identities, that they're emerging as a force to be reckoned with.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, we might call them transnationals or trans-state identities. I mean, there's lots of fancy literary theory and post-colonial theory that's looked at this, but, you know, generally speaking, the phenomenon has been overstated.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe not now. Maybe, that kind of theorizing had a great predictive value. And so I'm wondering if the model that Richard Florida is employing is rapidly going to become antiquated, you know, and irrelevant. that as we think of regional economies, we think of them as contiguous spaces.
Yeah.
I'm not so sure that that fits very well with emergent socialization online. It doesn't do a very good job of understanding the blogosphere, that's for sure.
Here's a pretty interesting question, and I was just speculating about this in next week's column for InfoWorld. It grew out of my adventure in Second Life, where I was invited to attend a meeting with breakout sessions, and it was a complete catastrophe from my perspective in terms of having any kind of productive simulation of a face-to-face meeting. But it got me thinking again about, you know, where are the constraints. One of them is, why, even though many people now have the option to do video conferencing, is it hardly ever preferred? And, you know, it could boil down to something as simple as there's a threshold frame rate. You know, it may not even be at all about the kind of pixel resolution that we imagine, you know, like the Cisco HD video conferencing that people are talking about just in the last week, for example, is focusing on hyper realistic pixel dense displays. But maybe if you think about the way people read faces and they're these micro expressions that we interpret without really even knowing that we saw them, but there's this emotional language of the facial musculature that we all interpret. And when we say, I want to be there in person at, you know, for that critical meeting because I want to look the other guy in the eye, it really, in fact, could well be more, I need to read the micromusculature of his face. And if those movements are fleeting, which they are, they occur in just a fraction of a second, you know, we could wake up one day and discover that the difference between 15 frames per second and 30 frames per second, for example, is critical. And that's just one example of what we were saying before, that, you know, that what we don't know here in terms of how, and I like your phrase, distance trust, that what we don't know yet about how that could work is, well, we hardly know anything about how it could work.
Right. Well, I think we do know some things. We put a high value on face-to-face interactions, and I think a lot of that has to do with our training. You know, you're in a school, you're learning, so go back to primary school. Everything is predicated upon face-to-face interaction. We're socialized in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly, to some extent, you have to say, well, maybe we're hardwired that way.
I'm sure we are.
But then there are so many examples of trust that have nothing to do with face-to-face interaction.
Mm-hmm.
So again, we can look at nation state. So why does somebody in northern Maine trust somebody in Texas whom they've never met more than they trust this person that they run into every once in a while who lives across the river in New Brunswick?
Mm-hmm.
You know, why do they trust an American more than the face-to-face interaction with the Canadian? So you have these interesting paradoxes.
Well, so answer the question. Why does the person in Maine trust the person in Texas more?
It's a matter of nationalism, that the person in Maine believes the person in Texas has a shared concern. Okay, and the person in northern Maine does not believe that the person in New Brunswick has a shared concern.
Okay.
Face-to-face interaction does not necessarily engender trust. You know, in this case, it doesn't at all. It doesn't overcome the sense of shared concern that Americans feel.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think that's a very flawed sense of trust, but nonetheless, it's a very powerful one.
Right.
And one that can marshal people to do very great things.
Right.
So when I look at networking problems, I tend to think about them in terms of not how can we make this more like face-to-face, but how can we socialize people to effectively interact in a non-face-to-face environment?
Mm-hmm.
How can we create a similar sense of engagement and trust on a message board?
Yep.
That we see in a conference where everyone's gathered?
Yeah. Well, I've certainly spent a whole lot of years developing that perspective in myself and with other people who I have never and will never meet face-to-face. Probably, in fact, the majority of people with whom I have interacted professionally in the last 20 years are people that I may never meet face-to-face. And so I have certainly learned to place a high degree of trust in the evidence of what people think based on how they write. Now we're entering this realm of, you know, sort of multimedia, and it's getting to the point where I think that that's going to start to have a tremendous effect too. The amount of audio information that I absorb now is a complete surprise to me. I wouldn't, 3 years ago, I wouldn't have begun to imagine that I would be spending so much of my hiking and bicycling and jogging time with headsets on, listening to an amazing variety of different perspectives coming from people who have given talks in one location or another that are just available as MP3 files. I know about Richard Florida's work not because I read his book, but because I heard him give a talk. And in some ways, the sense that I got of who he is and how he thinks and what he's about was incredibly rich because of the emotional quality of the voice. The audio channel is a relatively new opportunity. It's a huge change from how things were for me and for a lot of people now who are walking around with headsets on from just 3 years ago.
When you're saying this, it reminds me a little bit of Radio Nation. So before, pre-television, I have this image of Americans at various certain times all huddled around the radio, listening to the same show.
Yeah.
That gets back to the idea of why the person in Maine feels more connected to the person in Texas, is that, hey, you watch the same television I do, you're listening to the same news program on the radio that I'm listening to.
Yeah.
That's that touch point that connects people, and they share that experience, and they share those values.
Yeah.
What we're looking at now, perhaps, is something that's akin to that, though, of course, we have infinitely more options, and we can listen to these things whenever, so it's not like we're all huddled around at the same time listening to the same show.
One of the things that people rightly complain about having been lost in this environment of not just 500, but tens of thousands of channels, is the sense of shared attention.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the case that anyone can reliably expect to refer to the television show that was on Thursday night with a high degree of confidence that the person they're talking to will also have seen it. But the importance of having a canonical URL for some piece of audio, let's say, on the internet, is exactly that you can discover who else is attending to that same thing. So
Right. The
notion that you can find out, and it still obviously isn't going to be the same as there were 40 million people tuned into this one thing. So it doesn't create community on that scale, and it never will. But at the level where it's important for these smaller, more active kinds of cooperative groups, the ability to know who has read or heard or seen what and to be able to visualize that is a pretty important, can be a really important way of binding that community together.
I think that could be a centerpiece of trust at a distance.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's these small networks or small groups of people that have very precisely defined interests.
Yeah.
They share these interests. And I think trust is built up in that way. So this is how I find out about other people. I blog. Someone says, hey, I noticed that. And then I look at what they're looking at.
Yep.
And I check all that out. And I see, well, about 70% of what they're looking at, I find very interesting and resonates with everything I'm doing.
Right.
I think there's a high level of trust that springs from that very brief and small interaction,
mm-hmm.
because there's an incredible amount of information transmitted, just in the, what is somebody looking at? What are they listening to? What are
mm-hmm.
they thinking about?
Mm-hmm.
How do they think?
Yep.
Being able to see that is extremely powerful, and it's incredibly efficient.
Yeah.
Richard Florida, I've celebrated him, I've critiqued him. He provided me with one of my most powerful connections in that on his blog, he mentioned my blog.
Right.
And then next thing I know, I've got, my readership goes crazy, and I got people reaching out to me. Hey, I'd like to help, or this is very interesting. I found out about you through Richard Florida's blog.
Mm-hmm.
And it put me in touch with all these like-minded people.
Mm-hmm.
We're off toiling away in our little worlds, and wow, I mean, to the extent that my world expanded within 3 days, really dumbfounded me. I was like, I'd never expected that
right.
kind of response. I plod along and nothing's going on, and then all of a sudden, 2 or 3 days, there's like an explosion.
Yep.
And the world gets that much bigger, and I meet all these other people, And I would say that I have a high level of trust. I would collaborate with these people. I would help them out. You know, if they said, would you do this for me? Sure. I think I have more information online about people than I do in a face-to-face interaction.
Well, absolutely. And one of the most fascinating things that people started to discover about the blog phenomenon a couple of years ago, when it had been happening for long enough that people started to meet others face-to-face for the first time, but with a context that was acquired from knowledge of their blog over a year or two, was and is extraordinary. So it's wildly more productive if the person that you encounter for the first time in a business setting is a person that you've interacted with in this virtual space for a while, and you in some sense really do know one another, and there already is a level of trust and a level of knowledge about one another's interests and commitments. And building on top of that, the face-to-face meeting can dispense with, you know, what would otherwise be perhaps pretty lengthy preliminaries and, in a sense, get right down to business, you know. So this is, it's absolutely not an either-or kind of thing. You know, I mean, in fact, very consciously now, I feel like interaction through the blog network in advance of a face-to-face meeting is an essential prerequisite to having the best use of the FaceTime.
Yeah, exactly. It's definitely not an either-or proposition, and you know, and I'm definitely not proposing an either-or.
Right.
You know, what we're looking at is an integration of social technologies that advance the kinds of thinking we can do, particularly collaboratively. You know, that from my experience in the academic environment, I was enormously frustrated with the inability of academics to work with each other and to interact across disciplines.
Mm-hmm.
I do this very easily in the blogosphere.
Yes.
I'm really struck by how easy it is.
Me too.
And I'm very excited about it.
This does require everyone involved to be more actively engaged with discourse that is mediated through electronic networks.
Right.
You know, whether that's blogging, whether that's being involved with a community site, like you have the example of the Steelers fan site, but all sorts of other affiliations are possible. And it's a mode of behavior that is absolutely atypical of people over a certain age, but completely typical of people under a certain age. And so I think we're not very far at this point from seeing the effects of that first live journal generation who 4 or 5 years ago, I remember saying, you know, there's this pulse of live journal 16-year-olds who are going to be college students in 5 years. And now it's 5 years later, so they are. 5 years after that, they're going to be in the workforce. And they're going to be bringing a set of expectations about how one projects identity into the network, how one collaborates and communicates with other people, which are just very different bedrock assumptions than anyone ever had before. You know, if it was 5 years ago to get them into college, another 5 years to get them into the workforce, you know, we're not that far away, perhaps, from having at least the soil in which what you're envisioning can grow be fairly well established.
I agree. I take Richard Florida with a grain of salt. I take these regional economic initiatives with a grain of salt.
Yeah.
Are we really projecting, you know, when are we looking into the future when we invest billions of dollars, literally, in these economic initiatives without really understanding the social transformations that are taking place?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the seeds have been sown. In fact, they're growing. And I look at a number of young people, and they're properly socialized to interact in a non-face-to-face environment.
Mm-hmm.
They can collaborate at a distance.
Mm-hmm.
They're very comfortable looking online for information and knowledge. And I think that they are cultivating skills of determining what's good and what's bad. I think they've been flying blind for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of interesting to see how it develops on its own. And I would love to see education more geared to this. You know, that if I could control all Pittsburgh's education, I would have, every year some sort of a module for interacting at a distance.
Oh, me too. I don't even get me started on this topic. Well, anyway, thanks for the fascinating conversation, Jim. I know that you're onto something here. I'm not sure exactly what it is, but I'm going to stay tuned into your blog and see how things turn out.